Hello, my name's Craig Barker. I'm the head of public engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum. Welcome to the podcast, Object Matters. Object Matters explores the relationship between our guests and a museum collection item or series of items. And for this episode, I'm very excited to be joined by Elise Cannon. Elise is a doctoral student here at the University of Sydney in the discipline of classics and ancient history, and she's also the Australian Archaeological Institute at Athens Research Fellow for 2023-2024. So before you head off to Athens, Elise, thank you so much for joining us. Big welcome to Object Matters.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel very privileged.
Now, before we begin, could I ask you a bit about your PhD research and how you got to be interested in this particular subject?
So as you said, I'm a doctoral student at the University of Sydney. I'm in my final year, so there's no pressure at all on that. A fun time to be moving overseas. So my doctoral thesis explores the different types of functional and emotive roles that dogs held in classical Greece, particularly in Athens. And I consider how developments and changes in their roles can shed further light on Athenian social history during this period. So basically, in a nutshell, I'm interested in working with different types of methods and mediums to look at how the history of dogs in Athens can help us learn a little bit more about the history of humans.
So you're really keen to integrate material culture and archaeological objects alongside written sources and, I'm assuming, epigraphy and funeral inscriptions and things like that, the whole gamut?
Yes, absolutely. It's coming from a classics and ancient history background, we don't get a whole lot of exposure to archaeology unless we do study the discipline at university. So for my part, it's really important for me to put the literary and the material side by side and see what I can contribute as a classicist to that field as well.
So why dogs? I mean, we all love dogs. I've got a beautiful dog at home. But you know, PhD is a big investment. What drew you to this particular topic?
Well, my interest in dogs goes a long way back. I initially wanted to be a vet when I was a kid. I always had a dog growing up. My childhood companion was an Irish wolfhound named Lady, but she was no lady, being an Irish wolfhound.
The tramp.
She was big and boisterous and extremely lazy.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was a kid, we had to upgrade my single bed to a queen-size bed so that she could fit in to sleep with me at night. I know that a lot of dog owners nowadays would probably not condone the practice of letting your dog sleep in your bed, but it was the 90s and I was a kid, so we'll make do. So I started dabbling in anthropology and historiography in 2015, and I was immediately interested in the reasons why and how humans have sort of altered their environs throughout history for the animals that they live with. So just like my family did when they bought me a much larger bed than needed so that my dog could stay close to me. When I was approached with the idea of doing my PhD on an animal-related topic, dogs were the only real option for me.
Yep.
Because I've always been passionate about the ways that dogs and humans affect change in one another. And that's kind of been an interest of mine since, you know, that I look back to from domestication onwards to today.
So when you're in Athens, the intention is what, to continue the research, but obviously we've access to the libraries and museums and collections there as well.
Yeah, so I've been really fortunate. I was not expecting to pitch a research fellowship proposal that would enable me just to finish my PhD and write an article. So I'm very grateful to the Australian Archaeological Institute Athens for believing in that side of the project and understanding how important it is for PhD students and research students in general to, especially in Australia, to travel to the country that they're looking at to get a sense of what that city is like, what it would have been like to walk around by the people who lived there, and to also have access to the incredible institutes and schools and libraries that are in Athens as well.
Mm.
So it's going to be a treat.
Oh, good luck. Make the most of it. So how are dogs depicted in ancient Greek art? For your research, obviously, you're focusing on the classical period, and we should explain to our listeners, when we talk about classical Athens, we're really predominantly talking about the 5th century BC, so more than 2,500 years ago. But there were presumably dogs being depicted in Greek art before that, and certainly were afterwards in the Hellenistic and Roman periods. Are there particular types of objects, and are there particular ways in which dogs are being depicted artistically?
Yes, absolutely. So generally speaking, when you're thinking of dogs in ancient Greek art, and especially in the classical period, so that 5th, early 4th century, you're thinking of those, you know, sleek, athletic, sighthound type dogs, the earlier version of our greyhounds and hunting and sporting dogs today. They've got these long, muscular abdomens, long legs and very thin, long tails that curve upwards around their back, quite high in the air. They've got short coats, long pointed muzzles, and their ears are often pricked up. These are certainly the most common types, yeah. And you'll often find these dogs on vase painting, on scenes, you know, including standard, sort of that common and mythical hunting scenes. You've got scenes of warriors departing, yeah. Charioting, and as well as other myth and ritual scenes. And you can also sometimes see them sitting beneath a couch in a symposium scene as which is quite cute and rare. It's nice when you see them.
Are we getting domestic scenes in that sort of, you know, playing with the kids at home?
Yeah.
Just like Lady?
Just like Lady, hanging out on the bed, perhaps. Aside from this more common type of dog, there are also the domestic companion dogs. You know, and they're much smaller and fluffier. And there are also some rare images of the larger molossus-type dog, which is generally more associated with guarding property, people, and the afterlife.
Yeah. Are there particular species of dog that are identifiable through vase painting and other artistic depictions, or is it more concept of dog? Obviously, breeds of dogs have changed considerably just in the last 100 years, let alone 2,500 years ago. But, you know, are there things that are recognisable as a Dalmatian or whatever?
Yes and no. It would be amazing if we had some sort of document that was, you know, akin to the standard dog breeding guidelines and kennel clubs that we have today. That would be great for what I do. But mostly when we're thinking about ancient dog breeds, I tend to think about them in terms of types. So the way that these dogs are often described, it's generally by location. So you've got dogs that are from the Laconian region, Spartan hounds, Cretan hounds, molossus dogs, Epirian hounds, and so they're all quite location-based, but they have similar forms.
Yeah, right. I mean, I guess it's interesting because unlike something like a lion that most artists probably never saw in the flesh before they depicted them, dogs are everywhere. So, you know, it's actually access to an animal that you know quite well artistically. Do you kind of see wonky ones where they just don't look right, or are they generally pretty consistent in the different various media used by artists?
They are generally consistent. I've definitely seen a few that I've wondered if it is a dog or a rabbit or a really, really large cat. But I think they've got it down pat in terms of the stock standard types of dogs.
This is dog.
Yeah.
So, are there common motifs? I mean, you talked about hunting scenes, I mean, domestic and so on, but, you know, what are the really common ways? I mean, I'm assuming they're actually pretty common on Greek vases and other media as well, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. So, of all the animals represented in Greek art, the dog is the second most represented behind the horse.
Okay.
And in vase painting, of all the vases that we have out there in the Beazley Archive, the archive which logs most all of the vases out there.
And this is the work done by Sir John Beazley back in the middle of the 20th century out of Oxford University, where he was cataloguing black figure and red figure vases made in Athens for museums all around the globe, wasn't he?
Yes, and now it's an online database that people can use, which is incredible for international researchers. It's searchable in so many different ways, and you can find most anything on there, which is really good as well. So in that Beazley archive, there are about 1,200 vases which represent either a single dog or multiple dogs on them, which is quite a lot.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. And so what I find most fascinating about the representations of dogs above all animals, and that's because I'm mostly biased anyway, but it's the scope of context that you find them in. You see them in hunting, guarding, with children and with women as well. You see them in symposia, in sanctuaries, in warrior scenes, departure scenes, and the like. There's just so many.
Yeah.
For example, one of my favourite scenes is on a vase that shows two men who are cutting into and gutting a large fish. And the fish is on the bench. and there are two dogs right underneath the bench. One's looking up at the fish and one is looking down with its nose on the ground. Right. So it looks as though they're kind of waiting for offcuts or kind of consuming what's dropped off the bench, the little innards that are left over. And so you wouldn't normally associate dogs with preparation of fish at all, but there's an example of it.
Right.
And it seems to be something that was normal or at least understandable enough for it to be painted on a vase, which I think is very interesting. And in terms of being a common motif, because there are 1,200 just in vase paintings, when you start to see dogs in the ancient record, you will just start seeing them everywhere. You'll be incapable of imagining the ancient Greek record without them.
Which does make sense. They're part of our modern life. Why wouldn't they be part of an ancient life when they've been domesticated for so long?
Exactly. Yeah. This is not a new phenomenon by ancient Greek times.
So what do you hope that your research will contribute to our broader understanding of the social history of dogs in ancient Greece?
Well, again, no pressure for a final year PhD student. But at its core, my research is underpinned by the desire to promote awareness for the ways that animals help shape our lives, our histories, and our understandings of ourselves.
So, Object Matters is a podcast about collection items and the way that someone like you engages with them. What object, or I believe there's two objects you've selected from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collections. Could you tell us what are the vases that you've chosen for us to talk about today?
Absolutely. I couldn't stop at one. And luckily they're very tiny, so they're kind of like one larger object.
But they're lovely, complimentary, aren't they?
They're beautiful. Yeah. They're beautiful. So these vases are actually very special to me. I first came across them while I was doing some database work for the Nicholson Museum back in 2013. And I remembered entering the dimensions of these vases into the database and being struck at just how small they were compared to other vessels in the collection.
Could you describe them to us?
So we're looking at two miniature red figure koes. They're child size wine vessels used to hold a little bit of wine. So being red figure, they're dated to approximately 425 to 400 BCE. Yep. I'll get into the significance of that dating shortly. So they're very small. The two vases, one is about 6 centimetres in height and the other one is between 7 and 8 centimetres in height.
Tiny, aren't they? Yes.
And they've got a little handle at the back and a nice lip at the front to make for an easy pour.
Yep.
And because they are so closely associated with children, particularly, I like to think of them as a kid's wine sippy cup. So a small version of a standard couss.
I mean, they certainly look like miniature versions of a jug, don't they? I know there's been a lot of academic discussion and scholarly debate about how these were actually used by children. Were they functional or were they more decorative as such? I mean, what's the latest thinking about their relationship with children? So I know some of our listeners will probably be quite horrified at the idea of drinking wine for young children, but of course it's, that's seeing it through the lens of the modern world, but also, bearing in mind that the wine actually would have been safer to drink than the water in some cases in the ancient world. What's the latest scholarly thought on them?
Well, I think that I can't imagine children getting inebriated on, especially considering the size, it's not going to hold a lot of
the
wine.
The Greeks were obviously diluting wine as adults too.
Absolutely.
So you would have done the same.
It's far too strong.
Yeah.
There is a lot of debate around whether or not these were grave goods, and especially given the date that these were manufactured between 425 and 400 BCE, Athens in particular, where these vessels were manufactured, was experiencing a serious downturn in their population numbers due to not only the Peloponnesian War, but also multiple bouts of the Athenian plague.
Yep.
So I think we can kind of understand in the context of COVID just what the Athenians were going through. The other side of the debate is that perhaps these vessels were used as part of the Anthesteria festival.
This is the flower festival, isn't it?
Yes, the flowering festival, a 3-day festival in the city of Athens, where it's kind of related not only to Dionysus and the celebration of opening new jugs of wine and then getting into the next harvest, but it was also a festival that touched on mortality and death, where on one day all of the souls of the city would be wandering around the city, and people would stay indoors and have solemn, quiet feasts together, and they would ritually drink from this jug. Some people think that they might have been competitively drinking and getting a bit drunk, but there's no consensus.
Yeah.
So ultimately, we don't know what they were used for in that sense then.
Yeah, it's definitely a tricky one. It has been suggested that as part of this Anthesteria festival, children who reached a certain age of around 3 years old, they would have their first taste of wine from this particular shape and sized vessel to represent their transition into a new phase of childhood and social status.
Yep.
And so even if some are grave goods and some were actually used, the intent of the function is still there.
Got it, yeah.
So it could be that some were intended for children who perhaps in this context did not survive for the plague or infant mortality, and some who actually did get to use them.
Yeah.
So it's tricky.
It's quite poignant,
actually. Yeah, it is, it is. Yeah.
So let's look at each of the vessels in more detail. Now, there are images of both on the website, and again, both are accessible through the Chowchak Wing Museum's online collection search as well. So, Elise, how did they get to Sydney? I believe one of them was a donation of Sir Charles Nicholson, part of the original collection.
Yes.
And then the other one came as part of Professor Arthur Dale Trendall when he was curator of the museum immediately after World War II, and it was a gift of the Classical Association. Neither of them have an archaeological context?
No. It's tough to figure out with a lot of these vessels, specifically this shape and size. Sometimes they're found in graves, sometimes they're not, and with the nature of a lot of archival information, it's quite sparse. So, yeah,
particularly for the 19th century as well.
Yeah, so it doesn't really help us in trying to figure out what these two specific vases were doing.
So what's actually depicted on both of the vases? What do we see within those panels?
So I'm going to talk about both of these vases together because of those, the 1,200 representations of dogs that I mentioned earlier, there are 24, roughly, I think. I might have to double check my archive on that. Versions of this particular koos with this particular type of dog and a child on it.
Yep.
So when you look at these two vases together, they form part of a broader...
A corpus.
And when we start looking at the different ways that particularly the dogs are represented on them and this particular type of dog, we can learn a lot more about how the dog actually functioned within this domestic space, particularly in the 5th century. So the first vase, NM46.49, depicts a girl carrying a plate with some sort of food on it. It looks like it could be grapes, and because the vase is quite small, perhaps the finer details of that are not easy to discern.
Yeah.
But it could also be something completely else. I'm open to suggestions. So she's walking away from a table with some other objects on it.
Yep.
And just ahead of her, a very small dog, considering that we are dealing with a young girl here.
Yep.
So obviously this dog is quite petite. And it has a very bushy tail that's curved kind of up past its back.
It's almost like a rabbit tail, isn't it?
I know. This is why I keep getting a bit confused sometimes. I'm like, is it a dog or is it some other small, tiny beast? And so it's got this, you know, very bushy tail around its back. It's got short, pointed ears, and it has a stubby little muzzle. And it's bounding forward as though it's running towards a space out of the actual scene.
Yep.
So the second vase.
And this is the one Sir Charles Nicholson presented to the collection?
Yes. So that's NM98.37. It also shows a girl holding out some sort of food. This one kind of looks a bit more like grapes to me, just by the way that she's holding it.
Could be like a steak or something too.
It does also kind of look like a T-bone, but I'm not sure if that's really the ancient Greek predilection for eating T-bone steak. Might be an area of future inquiry. We don't know. So she's holding out some grapes, but unlike the first vase that I just described, the dog in this one is seated and looking up at the girl as she holds the food out to it. And it looks as though she's offering the dog a tasty snack.
Yeah.
So these two vases are great because they show two very different dog behaviors around food. Vase one shows the dog running ahead as though it's in anticipation and excitement.
Yeah.
While the other vase shows the dog seated and behaving very well, as though it's good behaviour.
It's like it's receiving its treat. Yeah.
It is, it is. They're also both lovely examples of human interaction with dogs, and it's because they show both human and animal engaging closely with each other in that domestic space, which is something that in the 5th century, especially during and post the two waves of the Athenian plague, children and women in domestic spaces, particularly children, starts really taking off in the artistic styles at the time.
They're lovely scenes. They are so domestic that you can imagine these exact scenes being played out in backyards all around the world, can't you?
Absolutely.
The dogs themselves, I mean, because they're, as you mentioned, they're quite tiny, these fall into the more fluffy style of dogs?
Yes. So it's generally assumed that the dog on these two coes, as well as the others that are out there, is the Melitian, which is a small, white, fluffy coated breed or type, that its origins are a bit dubious. It could be from the island of Melite, or it could be somewhere else off the coast of Malta. It's down to translation, really. Yeah,
understood.
But it's the dog that is the most commonly associated with being kept for pleasure and companionship.
Yep. Right.
So it starts to be, this particular type of dog starts to be depicted in the Attic material record from around 500 to 480 BCE.
Yep.
And there's just a few examples of them before 450 BCE, and they are mostly with male figures at this time, which is why I find these two particularly interesting. And I won't have time to get into it today, but the literary evidence for this breed during this classical period is very sparse.
Mm.
And it's not until the late Hellenistic period onwards that we start to get a lot more textual evidence for them as lapdogs and companions.
Right.
But they're very clearly here in the visual record.
Yeah.
And that's when they start to become a lot more represented as well.
And you talk about these are two of that corpus of 24 that you've been able to identify in the BZ records. Mm. Are the other 22 young girls with similar dogs, or is there a little bit of variation?
There's a lot of variation. There are several that have infants who are on their bellies or crawling with their arms outstretched to these little dogs, which is quite sweet as well, because oftentimes these dogs will mirror the behaviour of the infants that are on the vessels as well. They might hold up a paw or be looking up to sniff at them and things like that. You will get some boys. Infants are sometimes hard to figure out if, you know, what sex they are. But they've got amulets around them, which tells us a little bit more.
Yes. Yeah.
There's some, you know, some visual significance there. There are also some where there are other animals as well. There's one with a little bird in it. But generally, the focus is on one child, one dog in the small scene.
And they're obviously fascinating little vignettes in terms of the conceptualization of childhood as well, too, because it's changed so radically throughout human history as well. But in terms of your research, how were Athenians thinking of childhood at this point in time? Were there profound changes in the concept of childhood taking place because of the social upheavals at the time that you mentioned before, the Peloponnesian War and the plagues?
Yes, there's been a lot of excellent scholarship out there on these particular vessels and some others as well for how they show changing representations and conceptualizations of childhood, especially between the 450 to the 400 BCE.
Yep.
And that's rightfully so, because it's fascinating. And so during this period, we see a shift shift in how children are represented. They're much more nuanced and realistic in comparison to earlier versions where they have six packs. And, you know, kind of look like just smaller
miniature adults. Yeah.
And during this time, we've got, you know, there's more attention paid to what infant and children's body shapes look like. They're a bit chubbier. They're shorter in parts. And that really coincides with a very interesting period in Athenian history. And as I had touched on, Athens had experienced at least two waves of plague, which had decimated its citizen population and obviously would have decimated its non-citizen recorded population as well. And Thucydides gives us great information about what the plague was sort of like at that time as well, and it was just tragic. But given that the Peloponnesian War was occurring during this time as well, a seriously declining number of military age men would also have been a problem.
Yeah. So a lot of these children would be orphans.
Indeed, and if they were lucky to get to that, you know, that age of three to have their first taste of wine, hopefully they would reach then the age where they would go and start their training as well.
Yeah.
So it's an important moment that is kind of signified by these shifts in representations of childhood as well. And this has been examined by really renowned scholars like Leslie Beaumont and Greta Ham, Mark Golden, etc. And recognizing children who reach this transitional age to receive their first kous and taste the new wine obviously must have received some greater importance in light of this significant context of death and trauma. But while the focus of scholarship has been on these children, and rightfully so, I just can't not look at why it is these dogs.
The dogs.
These dogs that the literature does not really touch on, but we know from later sources were only associated with being pets and lap dogs. So what I'm interested in is, what is it about how these changing representations of childhood, why is it that they coincide with the emergence of this particularly fluffy, petite type of dog on domestic and childhood scenes? It's so strange. And these vases are particularly important to me because they're emblematic of what my research looks at. Is it what can we learn about how dogs were being conceptualized during this time?
Yep.
And what can they tell us about how dogs were becoming understood as domestic animals that could function solely as companions in the household without necessarily needing to fulfill these other utilitarian functions such as hunters and guardians? And because there is a disparity in the number of literary references to them during this time compared to the visual, these vases are amazing because they help give us a better picture of how these dogs are becoming gradually more commonplace enough to be so broadly associated with being a lap dog by the Hellenistic period, especially in households that could afford to have a domestic dog as a companion or household animal. Yep.
So you feel that that connection between the humans and our best friends on the vases are really representational of a much larger societal change that's taking place?
Yeah, I think that there are two histories that are played out on these vases. There's one of childhood and changing conceptualizations, representations of childhood, and there's also one of changing conceptualizations of dogs as companions, solely as companions. So I think that the child and the dog on both of these vessels help narrate and articulate one another. What they tell us about the connection between human and dog is that we're always in dialogue with one another, even though we don't speak the same language. We do help to define one another. And dogs offer us a window not only into ourselves, but also into our wider sociocultural approaches to animals and to companion animals, and how that's been shaped over tens of millennia of domestication. So our relationship with dogs are always changing, and they can be interpreted in many different ways. But at the core, and I see this a lot with ancient Greek art as well, is a connection between human and animal that was forged at domestication and has impacted humans and our history as much as we've helped impact the dog as well.
Our best friend.
Our best buddy.
So you talk about that change in connection with these two particular vases, because you've now seen them over almost a decade, actually. But, I mean, have you found the way that you've connect with the vases changed as your research has progressed?
Yes. These vases are probably the best example of how my perspective, my research method, and my scholarship has grown and shifted over the years. So when I first encountered them, I was struck by their size and the curiosity of these little dogs, without knowing an awful lot about the context, their dating, and the number of vases within this specific period. I also knew very little of ancient breeds or types of dogs at all. Coming from a classics background, my first instinct was to go looking for literary references to this type of dog. And after finding mainly later references, I realized that I had to go back to the museum, talk to classical archaeologists, and learn new ways to integrate the material evidence and synthesize that with the literary. This has resulted in a much richer research process. It's definitely made my PhD journey far longer than I anticipated, but learning how best to combine the literary and the visual has allowed for a much more enjoyable research as well.
A much more holistic research.
Indeed, but it does also mean that I can't go to a museum now without seeing a dog somewhere or anywhere. And that's also quite lovely, at times potentially triggering, but it also, I think that it speaks to the enduring legacy of dogs in antiquity and today.
Yeah.
They're everywhere, and it's such a nice testament to human's best friend.
Yeah. Now, the question everyone who appears on the podcast gets asked is this one.
Okay.
If you could choose one word to signify what these two vases represent to you, what's the word that you would use?
Nuanced, for lack of a better word. I think it's because while these vases are both so small and there's just two figures on each of them, there is so much going on them. There is concepts of childhood, there's ritual, there's post-plague sentiment, there's the conceptualization of dogs as household animals and companions. And for such small objects, they encompass so much about Greek and particularly Athenian social history. And we're just so lucky to have them here in Australia for people to view.
Yeah. So they're both on public display at the moment. When visitors come to the Chowchak Wing Museum, what would you like them to think about when they have an opportunity to stop and view these tiny little vases?
I guess it comes back to my desire to highlight just how important animals are to human history. They might not seem, especially these dogs might not seem like they're particularly important figures on vases, but the fact that they're chosen to be included at all tells us that they are important to the overall narrative of the scene. There's just so much to unpack about Greek social history and our own social histories by looking at how humans interact with animals over time. So I hope that looking at a child holding out some grapes or a T-bone to a little dog, we can think about our own relationships with dogs and how they've changed as well.
Mm. Give your dog a pat right now.
Absolutely. Hug your papa.
Thank you so much, Elise. That's been fascinating. Thank you. Good luck with your research while in Athens. Hope you have a wonderful time. Thank you for joining us on Object Matters.
My pleasure.
Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The University of Sydney and the Chowchak Wing Museum acknowledges the traditional custodians of these lands, and we pay our respect to elders past and present.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chowchak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.